Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchak. Today we take you to the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor for a conversation between former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and historian Ted Widmer. This talk is one of many from the 2020 Champlain Institute, whose theme is November 3rd, What's at Stake? It was originally presented online on July 27th, 2020. The title of today's talk is An Evening with Hillary Clinton. We'll hear her thoughts on the consequences before us as we vote in the next election. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. It will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing the conversation today is Phil Lader, former U.S. Ambassador to the Court of St. James's.
Ted Widmer is a favorite of the Champlain Institute, a prize-winning historian. He's had academic degrees from Harvard three times. He has had faculty appointments at Harvard, Brown, and other prominent institutions. His most recent book, Tracing the Growth of Abraham Lincoln as a Statesman, was called by the Washington Post a Lincoln classic. But Ted is uniquely qualified for today's program, especially given our guest. He served as a White House speechwriter and was senior advisor to both President Clinton and subsequently Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. Hillary Rodham Clinton, how do you introduce the most well-known woman in the world? She has literally lived the history of her generation. Well, maybe some numbers can help tell part of the story. 65 million Americans voted for her. More votes for a presidential candidate than any other in history other than Barack Obama. 112 countries, more than a million miles, 401 days on the road as Secretary of State. Most admired woman in the world, 10 years in a row. For many, our national memories have been punctuated by images of her. I mean, think of that Life magazine photograph of a 60s co-ed giving the graduation address at Wellesley College. The young Yale Law School graduate who is researching constitutional history for the Watergate Committee and then championing children's rights for the Children's Defense Fund. A full-time trial lawyer while being First Lady of Arkansas. The very devoted and protective mother of an extraordinary and most accomplished daughter. She was the First Lady who championed healthcare reform. She also, in China, spoke out her mind and many others when she said that human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights. She was subjected to constant public scrutiny, relentless partisanship. Then as a U.S. Senator, she won the praise for her hard work by her colleagues from John McCain to Ted Kennedy. Secretary of State, she faced down brutish authoritarianists. It was she who, in that particular role, always was in the room when the toughest foreign policy decisions were made. She was the candidate who believed that we could be stronger together. It's that strong voice that, in her moment of supreme disappointment, spoke out to our daughters, yours and mine, to never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams. But the world's most well-known woman may well be the most frequently mischaracterized and least understood. My wife, Linda's, and my enormous privilege over the years has been to be with her in times of celebration and trial and loss. on occasions of some hard choices. We shared laughter with her wonderful mother. We picked up toys left behind by our daughter's, little daughter's friends. We've walked down paths none of us would have ever imagined for ourselves. She started a conversation at Yale with a fellow from Arkansas in 1971. And today, almost 50 years later, they're still each other's best friends. She's been a change maker all of her life, driven by a deep religious faith, by the teaching of John Wesley, when he admonished us to do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. One incident perhaps best conveys the Hillary that Linda and I know. Kindness, compassion, a sense of humor. For many years, we celebrated New Year's together as families. And always sentimental, I always want my wife and daughters and I to be together at the stroke of midnight. One year, however, when our elder daughter was about six, she was playing with friends and just didn't get over to us in time. As we finished singing Auld Lang Syne, this little girl rushed over, very much in tears, and said, "Daddy, I'm so sorry that I missed being with you at midnight." As I lifted her up, this crying child, Hillary leaned over and whispered, "Mary Catherine, do you know that Little Rock is in a different time zone? It's not midnight there yet. So why don't we just stay here together and we'll still be able to celebrate New Year's together?" A tearful but now smiling child, comforted by a very understanding and most compassionate friend. That's the photograph I have on my office shelf here in Maine. And that's why all of us, in one way or another, connecting with Hillary Rodham Clinton, are so pleased to have Ted Widmer tonight interviewing Hillary Rodham Clinton. Ted?
And just hearing you speak reminds me how many people have come together from the community of Mount Desert Island to Lynn and Darren and the faculty and students of College of the Atlantic to make this a really special ideas festival. It's my third year at the Champlain Institute. I wouldn't miss it for anything. And in the summer of 2020, I'm so glad to attend an event that has not been canceled. So thank you for persevering. And Madam Secretary, thank you for being our kickoff speaker. We're all just so excited to talk with you, hear from you. We're spending this week talking about what's at stake for the United States in 2020. It's already been quite a year. Me Too, COVID, George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, so many other pressing domestic and foreign policy problems. Are you honestly a little bit relieved to be a grandma in Westchester County?
Oh, first of all, Ted, being with my grandchildren is the biggest silver lining in this very dark cloud that hovers above us. And so I certainly am grateful for the time that I have with them. I would, however, still rather be in a position to deal with some of these serious challenges that we face and to try to bring people together to solve problems and look for ways to be, as I heard in Phil Lader's very kind introduction, Stronger Together. But I'm delighted to be part of this Champlain Institute conference, this Ideas Festival. I was so looking forward to being with all of you in person, and I hope you'll give me a chance in a future year to come back. But I'm delighted that we could carry on, and I could not think of anyone I'd rather talk to than you, Ted. And I'm going to put in a shameless plug for your book, Lincoln on the Verge, which is absolutely a thrilling read and also a great commentary on where we are today in our country.
Well, thank you so much, Madam Secretary. Your words meant so much to them. I read them in People magazine, and I'd always wanted to appear in People magazine. And thanks to you, I now have, and I'm very, very grateful. Well, as Phil said in his introduction, you've worked in every kind of politics, from your advocacy for children in the late 60s and early 70s. You worked, of course, at the state level in Arkansas, and then in many different high-level positions inside the White House, in the Senate, and as Secretary of State. What practical political steps can our very divided country take to heal our politics and begin to return to a more functional two-party political system?
Well, I certainly hope that we can make progress to move toward that goal again. You know, as you said, I've been involved in one way or another in both policy and politics my entire adult life. There have always been deep differences of opinion and disagreements. There have always been partisan divides over what direction we should go, how far, when. But at least there were processes, structures, institutions in place that provided opportunities for people to come together, to follow certain norms of behavior that had been, you know, set up over generations, to try to see whether it were possible to find common ground. I remember being, as Phil said, on the impeachment inquiry staff investigating President Nixon, and the lawyers were Republicans and Democrats, experienced and junior like myself, and they were absolutely committed to the facts, to the evidence, wherever it might lead. And I watched these professionals, and then I watched members of Congress on both sides of the aisle weigh the evidence that was presented. There was such a devotion to trying to get it right in the sense of coming to some understanding of the facts and evidence and then making decisions based on that. You know, certainly when I was in the Senate, and it seems like a long time ago, but I was there for 8 years, 2001, 2009, when I left to be Secretary of State. Yes, there were big differences, but we found ways of working together and the institution functioned. I mean, we had actual hearings with witnesses appearing before us. We had actual markups of bills where different senators would put forth their amendments and their objections. We had debates on the floor about serious matters. We would win some on my side and we would lose some on my side. But I always felt as though there was a process that was reflective of the deliberativeness of the Senate. And so for me, I think, you know, we used to say in the Senate, regular order. People need to get out of their corners. They need to once again commit to institutions and processes, as boring as that may sound, Ted, because due process, procedural approaches are often the ways you cool the passions and create the space for people to come together. Now, I'm talking about decision makers and predominantly those in the Congress or legislative bodies, but I think that's true across the board. People have to be willing to commit to actually listening to each other. And we heard in the very beginning of the introduction about the process that was used in Dallas to bring people of every walk of life, every political persuasion together. There they were in a process where they talked, they listened, they learned, even changed their minds based on what they had learned, and then came to some conclusions about what they would do were they in the position to make such decisions. You know, maybe that's a good model to try to replicate across the country. You know, maybe there could be a way to bring more people together within a pre set up process to go through exactly what all of those Americans did in Dallas. But we are in danger of undermining all of our institutions, of forgetting all the lessons that were so hard learned about how a diverse population works together, learns, listens, talks, and decides. And I'd like to see us try to reinstate those approaches.
So we're on a college campus, although most of the students are at their homes. How would you speak to a college undergraduate about overcoming their alienation? And you, I would imagine, wrestled with feelings like that in the very divided politics of 1968 and 69 and 70, and yet you got over it and you did enter politics locally and then nationally. And what forms of advice would you give a young undergraduate?
It's a really interesting question. I've thought about that time in my life quite a bit in recent weeks, because you're right. I mean, any student who went through the assassinations of, Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy, of the extraordinary protests, demonstrations in the streets, the reaction by people, to those assassinations, to a feeling that, the world truly was coming to an end. I think about it because, those of us who were in college and then in law school, in my case, we had a choice to make. I mean, there were a lot of people who chose just to protest. I was somebody who chose to protest and work within the system. Just like I tell young people today, protest and vote. Peaceful protest and vote. And from my perspective, young people today are leading so much of the change that we need to see happen, particularly in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. And because none of us could turn away from that 8 minute, 46 second video of that man being killed, we have that common experience. We're not hearing a reporter talk about it. We're not hearing it secondhand from somebody who has an opinion about what we should think. We saw it. We saw it, and we could not turn away from it. So I think that young people who are leading a lot of the protests, a lot of the movement for change to deal with systemic racism, to really force the moral reckoning that is sadly overdue, they're the ones who I'm looking to help point us in the right direction. And I'm very optimistic that we can, if we approach this with a more open mind and a more open heart to interact with each other, listen to one another, actually make some of the long overdue changes that are required, which would give young people today, a sense of agency, a sense of contribution, of participation, that I hope would make them committed citizens to seeing through what is the long, slow, hard, boring of hard boards, as Max Weber said so many years ago, when it comes to political and particularly political change in a big, diverse populace and polity as we are.
As you know very well, your friend John Lewis was lying in state in the Capitol today after a tour of the civil rights sites of Washington, D.C. And throughout your campaign 4 years ago, you spoke with great sensitivity of racial injustice. You spoke about Ferguson and Charleston and microaggressions. And Black Lives Matter had, in a sense, already happened once. Were you surprised the way so many people were surprised at the eruption of a second and very forceful version of Black Lives Matter in May of 2020?
Well, I was only surprised to the extent that I wish it had not been necessary once again to react to what has again happened over and over again. You know, during the 2016 campaign, I did speak a lot about the need to come to grips with the unfinished business of dealing with racism and the inherent prejudices, almost implicit biases that, you know, people carry with us, and we all do. We all have to take a hard look at ourselves. And that was one of the real blessings and genius of John Lewis, you know, because he never, ever gave up on us, Ted. You know, he went forward as a young man into beatings and imprisonment and abuse of the most horrible kind because he believed, in his phrase, in the beloved community. He mm-hmm. wanted to see us live up to our highest ideals and the values that, you know, we pay allegiance to, but sometimes often fall short of. And he said many incredibly profound and wonderful things. But one thing he told young people, and this goes back to the prior question, which I particularly liked, was not to get discouraged, not to, you know, walk away when the going was tough, you know, not to believe that change would happen overnight, that laws would be written and then they would be enforced and people's attitudes would be changed just because injustice was so apparent. He said, do not give in, do not give up, and do not give out. And I think about that a lot, because if anybody deserved to give in, give up, and give out, it was somebody who went through what he did for his entire lifetime. But he never lost that sense of commitment, of mission, of purpose, of joy in trying to bring us all toward a more perfect union. So we celebrate his life, but the best way to really pay tribute to John Lewis is to continue his work. And one specific way would be for the Senate to pass the Voting Rights Act that really once again fulfills the need to ensure that every American has a right to vote and a right to have his or her vote counted, and call it the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. That to me would be the greatest tribute we could pay him.
We're focusing on the election in this week of talking, and the early signs about voting that have come from Georgia and New York a few weeks ago are not inspiring confidence. Do you have any practical suggestions for how people from both sides of the aisle might ensure the simplicity of an uncontested election?
Well, I think it's one of the biggest challenges we face right now. And I'm worried because, as you point out, we've had different states with different problems that have caused, you know, different outcomes in creating the election in the minds of people. So, for example, in Georgia, people who waited 7, 8, 10 hours to vote because there weren't enough voting sites or enough voting machines were rightly not only discouraged, but outraged. In New York, we're still counting mail-in ballots, and there are so many questions about why it takes so long and why so much work that needs to be done is not properly staffed. So I think every single state, and this should be nonpartisan, every single state, every local election official should be held accountable for ensuring that we have the best operating election, because this upcoming election is so fraught. It's going to be so hotly contested. Feelings are going to be just off the charts, emotional on both sides. So people should be doing everything right now to get ready. And the whole vote by mail issue is one that I'm particularly worried about, because a lot of people don't want to go out and vote because of COVID-19. So we need more early voting so that people, if they do feel comfortable venturing out, have a lot of opportunities to do so. We need vote by mail, where if your ballot is postmarked election day, it counts. Where the states provide prepaid postage, so no voter is disenfranchised because at the last minute they don't have a stamp to put on an envelope. Where there can be uniformity in how the ballots are examined and counted. My goodness, we've been arguing about this for many years, certainly most famously back in 2000 with hanging chads. And you have to ask yourself, is there some advantage that some people, and I'm not going to say which party, because sometimes it just comes down to incumbency or lethargy and inertia, but is there some advantage that people feel they have because they don't really take seriously the process of voting? So we have some time, about 99 days, I think, to try to get organized, get it fixed. But I'm supporting every effort I can by any group, partisan, nonpartisan, civic, political, to try to figure out how we can have the smoothest possible election, because the last thing we're going to need this upcoming election is any questions about the outcome, because, you know, that is just another body blow to our democracy if we don't get this right.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features a conversation between former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and historian Ted Widmer, discussing the consequences before us as we vote in the next election.
We were talking about John Lewis a minute ago, and here in Maine, another well-known profile in courage was the late Senator Margaret Chase Smith, a senator in the 50s and 60s. And famously, in 1950, she issued a declaration of conscience against her fellow Republican, Joe McCarthy, that did a great deal to slow down his movement and really lifted her up in the eyes of Democrats as well as fair-minded Republicans. And yet, and I'm now speaking my own opinion, we've seen a real lack of that kind of Republican leadership over the past few years. And what happened to the Senate, which used to be a kind of protected space for people to speak their minds regardless of party consequences or presidential punishment. And yet the Republican-led Senate has largely been mute over the last few years.
Well, first, Margaret Chase Smith is one of my political heroes. I have talked about her for many years when I accepted the nomination for the Democratic Party 4 years ago. The video introducing me included a lot of the women who I consider groundbreakers, and she was among them. And my daughter Chelsea and I wrote a book that came out last fall, the Book of Gutsy Women, and Margaret Chase Smith is in it, because I am absolutely an admirer of her and of her courage. And she did go where no one else would go. She stood up and made that speech in the Senate. She made that, you know, statement of conscience. She knew that she'd pay a political price, but she did it because she so believed that what McCarthy was doing was, number one, bad for the Republican Party, but number two, really bad for the country. And I don't understand why there are not more Republicans currently in the Senate who are willing to follow her example. You know, I served with some of the people who are still there, and I don't recognize them. I don't recognize at all how they don't speak out, how they are always equivocating, how they can look at what's going on, whether it's COVID-19 or Russian bounties on American military service men and women, and not hold the president accountable. It's just astonishing, Ted.
It is.
And I don't know all of the reasons why each of them has failed to do that. I want to call out Mitt Romney, who, you know, truly did stand up and cast a vote in the impeachment trial, which I know had to be hard for him. But he seems like a man who's at peace with himself and his conscience, just as Margaret Chase Smith was back in the early 1950s. I don't know why we're not seeing more of it. I don't get the hold that Trump has over Republicans up and down the ballot, but particularly in the Senate. I don't understand how so many governors, Republican governors, with few exceptions like Governor Hogan or Governor DeWine, have failed to stand up earlier to the propaganda coming out of the White House about the virus and follow the science instead of Trump. So this is going to be left to historians like you to try to unravel. What is the combination of either true believers, cult members, fear, intimidation about political viability? I don't know. But the fact is the Republican Party has failed at representing either its own values or standing up for the values of the country under the Trump administration.
I think it's going to be a huge challenge for historians of the future to try to explain the lack of logic and of civility and of respect for science and of old-fashioned political discourse that we saw over the last 3.5 years. It'll be hard to teach this time.
I don't know how so many people I worked with and, you know, thought of as being, you know, strong, maybe I disagreed with, but they were certainly, you know, people of conviction have basically just surrendered to him.
Presumably the COVID would have invaded under any presidency, but I imagine you would have handled it extremely differently. Do you mind elaborating on that?
Well, I think there will be a lot of postmortems on this as well. Here's what we know. We know that people within the administration, within the intelligence community, within the health community, within the White House itself, knew about what was happening in China early on, maybe as late as early as December, but certainly no later than January. And we know that the president did not take it seriously. He either did not read or listen to his intelligence briefings, or if he did, he chose to ignore it. And for a period of time acted as though it would disappear, that the Chinese were doing a great job. He had a conversation with Xi Jinping to that effect because he wanted it to go away. And it was such an abdication of intelligent leadership at a time when the country desperately needed a leader who had the confidence to be able to say what was known, what was not known, but to model the kind of behavior we were looking for. There were also inexplicable problems with the decision about how to best allocate personal protective equipment. A lot of confusion and seemingly intentional confusion over the national stockpile, which was put into place for just such events, not only pandemics, but, you know, biowarfare, natural disasters, things that were above and beyond what was normally to be expected. We also know there was a lot of ambivalence about using the Defense Production Act, which is there for a reason, to try to fill the gaps and provide the support that states and cities need. I mean, the list goes on, Ted, and in nearly every way that he could, the president failed the first and most important constitutional duty to protect and defend the United States, not just from external enemies, but internal ones as well, like what this pandemic has turned out to be. And so when I look at what they walked away from the prepared guidelines about what to do in a pandemic that the Obama administration left. They had a tabletop exercise before they took office where key figures of the incoming administration met with those of the outgoing administration to talk about handling a pandemic. And apparently it made absolutely no impression, or if it did, it could not in any way be used to influence the mm-hmm. president at a time when the president needed to be looking at the science, listening to experts, not to, you know, political advisors who were saying, you know, oh my gosh, you'll tank the stock market if you say we've got a problem. And so mm-hmm. we are faced with a situation that is so much worse than it needed to be. That's what I find really regrettable. You're right. I mean, the pandemic was global. It was going to come to our country, but we have lost more lives. We have imposed greater costs on our healthcare system. We have created even more civil disorder because of the way that this president has led. And unfortunately, we're nowhere near finished with the challenges the right. pandemic presents.
Well, I'm sure as a former Secretary of State, you're thinking a lot about the global ramifications of a disease that has not been eradicated and the continual decline of the reputation of the United States. But I want to ask specifically about women and girls around the world. There's a new article in Foreign Affairs by Melinda Gates saying there's a kind of second shadow pandemic that is affecting girls and women all around the world, especially in the developing world, where they are losing employment opportunities or they're trapped in domestic violence situations or have to stop their schooling. And can you talk about that and how we might mitigate some of those effects?
Well, Melinda Gates is absolutely right. There's been quite a bit of research about the impact of the pandemic on different populations. And yes, it's most acute in the developing world, where she points out the disproportionate effects on girls and women. Girls will be married off sooner as child brides for all kinds of economic reasons. Employment will dry up more quickly for girls and women than for boys and men. But I would add, Ted, that that's also something I worry about in our own country. If we don't mm-hmm. have childcare facilities, if we cannot safely open up our schools, then a lot of women are not going to be able, in their own minds and practically, go back to work. So the economic impact of this virus, which has cost tens of millions of jobs and cut back the economic prospects of so many Americans, will be made even worse. And again, disproportionately falling on women who are mothers. And so this is a problem across the board. The other thing is, the vast majority of healthcare workers are women. So the people on the front lines during this healthcare crisis have been, again, disproportionately women. The so-called essential workers, people who are stocking our grocery shelves, checking out our groceries, working in our pharmacies, a lot of them, a very high percentage of them, are also women. So it's kind of a real Hobson's choice. A lot of the women who mm-hmm. have to work are often working in some of the most vulnerable positions. A lot of other women who have to work can't figure out how to work without safe childcare reopening, without schools reopening. So Melinda focuses on the developing world, and we should all be looking for ways to try to alleviate the impact of the virus around the world. But we're also going to have to be paying close attention to what we do here at home as well.
Mm-hmm. I will ask one last question, and then we have a few from the audience that have been submitted already. But whoever wins the election in 99 days will start a new term on January 20th, 2021. In a sense, it's a chance for a reboot. And not only the things that a president does on a daily basis, like give speeches or introduce legislation, but maybe a chance for structural improvement, possibly with bipartisan support, new cabinet positions, new forms of regulation, new systems of bringing voters together from different backgrounds. Are there any thoughts you have about how we can together put some of the acrimony of the past few years behind us and become a better country again?
Well, sadly, I do not see that happening if Trump is reelected. I think he will double down on what has worked for him, which is a combination of insult and attack and vindictiveness and dividing Americans. So I don't have much hope there, but I hope that doesn't happen. That's my big hope. Because I know Joe Biden. I worked with him for many years when I was in the White House as First Lady, obviously when I was in the Senate, and then when I was a member of the Obama-Biden administration. He is always looking to bring people together. That is just his temperament. That is who he is. He wants people, to find ways to define and then occupy common ground together. I think he would be very open to that. But there's a real world example right now, Ted, that I bet most of the viewers haven't really heard about. There was a bill passed a week or two ago in the House called the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. And it passed with, of course, every Democrat, but also with Republicans. It was a bipartisan piece of legislation at the end. And so in the moment when the country needed to see that members of Congress could actually work together, they demonstrated that. Now, I don't want to oversell it because it wasn't a lot of Republicans, but even getting a couple these days is quite an accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And then it's gone to the Senate where, every piece of legislation goes and dies on Mitch McConnell's desk. And you cannot keep a democracy going. You cannot reestablish the trust, which is the glue that keeps a democracy functioning, if one branch of the legislative body refuses even to entertain the work of the other. And so there are dozens and dozens of bills that are just sitting there. As far as I can tell, the Senate does nothing except confirm the judges that, Trump sends them. They do no legislating. They had to do an act for recovery. They're going to have to do another one because the political consequences of that for incumbents would be too egregious. So they've got to pass something that keeps, some income flowing to a lot of Americans. But when it comes to the hard work of saying, what are we going to do to fix policing? The House did it. The Senate so far shows very little inclination to do so. But I think under a Biden presidency, you would see a much greater willingness of people once again to come together and try to, hammer out answers to a lot of our big problems.
Thank you. Here's a question from Maria Liz Biocci, an alumna of College of the Atlantic. In the history of the U.S., you were the first woman to receive a nomination for president by a major party, the first woman to participate in a presidential debate, the first woman to win the popular vote in a presidential election. What are some of the major challenges you have faced as a woman politician? How have you been able to overcome them? From what women protagonists of public life do you draw inspiration?
Well, that could take us for another hour. That's a lot. But
it is. I apologize.
Yeah, kind of, you know, but it's an important question. And briefly, let me just say that I wrote a book after the election called What Happened, because I couldn't figure it out myself. And I think I came up with a pretty good description of the major reasons why I won the popular vote, lost the Electoral College, and didn't become president. And I do have a chapter in there called On Being a Woman in Politics, which lays out some of the challenges women still face, the double standards that exist, the, you know, very deeply held beliefs about what is or isn't appropriate for women in this, you know, major executive position, the highest position politically in our country. And I think that any woman who is interested in perhaps getting into politics herself should definitely do it. It's far more rewarding than it is disappointing, at least in my experience. But be fully prepared, eyes wide open about the criticism mm-hmm. you will take, the need, as Eleanor Roosevelt said, to develop skin as thick as the hide of a rhinoceros, because that's what's going to happen. So much of it will not be fair. It won't be necessarily even about you, but you in the fact that you are out there running for position as a woman will, you know, encounter a lot of that. In fact, there's an op-ed in the New York Times today about some of the challenges that I faced when I ran in 2016, and some of the reasons why it is difficult for women to succeed in corporate America, in academic America, in certainly political America. And one little side note, though, we were talking about COVID-19. There's increasing agreement that the countries that did the best were all led by women. So New yes. Zealand, Taiwan, Germany, Finland, Denmark, you know, those are women who followed the science. They had inclusive governing patterns, and their countries have done better. So there are advantages to being a woman as well.
Well, your answer touches upon a question here from Mike Zwerko, an alumnus of COA. I served as city councilor for 4 years in my community. I recently took a step for higher office and lost. Months later, I was surprised at how much that loss affected my well-being. My question is, how did you cope with your loss, and how can you offer any advice on how best to cope?
Well, I'm still coping with it. I have to say, it is hard. When you throw yourself into running for office, I don't care what level it is, you are going to be in it, you know, body and soul. And you're going to do everything you can to win. And sometimes, as I know, you're successful, and sometimes you aren't. That doesn't come easy, though, because at the end of an election, particularly if, you know, you think there were things you could have done better, or things that were incredibly unfair or unprecedented that might have happened to you, you know, it does take some real effort. So, you know, look, I wrote a book about my election because I literally needed to understand it. I took a lot of long walks in the woods with my, you know, family and my closest friends. I spent a lot of time with my friends. I have the most extraordinary, wonderful friends. I read a lot. I obviously reached out and contacted either personally or by mail everybody who worked for me to thank them because they were feeling the loss as well. You know, even to this day, I have people who burst into tears when they see me or otherwise get really very upset because of how invested they were in the election. All I can tell you is time eventually helps, but You will always carry, the pain of having lost that election. Mm-hmm. But if you really want to serve, I hope you'll get back up and try again, because you never know. This is Joe Biden's, third campaign for president. And I think he's going to be our next president. So you just never know what might lie ahead of you if you keep trying.
Thank you. Here's a tactical question from Paul Growald from Shelburne, Vermont. You're the only Democrat who has experience debating Donald Trump. Do you think Joe Biden should agree to debate him? Why or why not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, the debates are part of the process. And I think that there will be, as there have been for the last many elections, three debates. And I think that Joe Biden should do them. And I think Donald Trump should do them. And they can, argue about the format and all the rules governing the debate. But I do think that it is part of the obligation of running for president. I felt good about all of my debates. I did prepare for them. A commentator famously said I overprepared, and Donald Trump attacked me in one of my debates because I had prepared so much. And I said, absolutely, I did prepare. And something else I prepared for was to be president. So you just do the best you can. And I think it's part of the, part of the campaign. And I would expect both candidates to show up and debate.
We're almost out of time, but I have a question here from Ambassador Jim Lowenstein, a friend of both of ours. If Biden is elected, what are the three most important steps in foreign policy he should prioritize?
Oh, wow. Well, Ambassador, you know that it's a big world out there and we are in a lot of trouble. We have to reassure our friends and allies who have been basically shaken and deeply, profoundly disappointed by the Trump administration as to whether or not America is a reliable friend and ally. We have to reassert our commitment to the structures of the international order, even though we should think about changes that will make NATO stronger, or the EU stronger, or any other institution. But somebody, and it'll have to be the president, the vice president, the new Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the whole team will have to spread out and reassure our friends and allies. We need to send a very clear signal to our adversaries, that this is a new day, and you don't put bounties on American soldiers and get away with it. You don't interfere in an American election and get away with it. You don't engage in aggressive behavior with your neighbors and get away with it. And I'm not calling for, military action. I'm calling for strong, tough diplomacy that will send a very clear message to Vladimir Putin that, his friendship with Donald Trump, which he manipulated to the nth degree to get what he wanted, is no longer running American foreign policy. In fact, we see Russia and Putin clearly for what they are, and we'll deal with them accordingly. And we have to do the same with China. I mean, there are lots of problems in our relationship with China, but I think that the heavy-handed, ill-thought-through efforts by the Trump administration have had very little effect. But I think much stronger, more focused, a more comprehensive approach, not just on trade, but on the whole range of our relationship with China needs to be undertaken. And, when you look at the trouble spots in the rest of the world, obviously the charade with North Korea that Trump went through has left us, weaker and our friends and allies in Asia more confused. Pulling out of the Iran deal, whether you were for it or not, and I was the person who started the negotiations, and I was definitely in favor of it because I thought it put a lid on the Iranian nuclear weapons program. And if you had problems with it, you could renegotiate, not pull out. That will have to be revisited. I hope there is still time to prevent Iran from going to nuclear weapons. We should get back into the Paris Climate Agreement, where we're the only nation right now outside of it, and gets the leverage that we need in dealing with not only the climate implications of internal decisions made by countries like India and China, but also leveraging it for economic reasons. I thought Joe Biden's climate policy that he put out a few weeks ago was excellent. He said, you know, some people, when they hear climate change, they hoax. When I hear climate change, I say jobs. And that's the right approach when we're trying to persuade people to do what we must do anyway. And as you can tell, I could go on and on, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and it will be a high priority for a President Biden, because that's where, you know, he spent so much of his time in the Senate and as vice president, worrying about and thinking about these international challenges and what truly is in America's national security.
Well, Madam Secretary, you've really lifted us up here in Bar Harbor, Maine. And I can't thank you enough personally for the intelligence and the factuality and the candor with which you've answered these questions. And you've left me feeling a lot of hope that our politics can work again. So thank you.
Amen. You know, I'm with Desmond Tutu. I'm a prisoner of hope. You've got to remain optimistic and got to make that part of the American DNA, Ted, which you know so much about.
Absolutely.
So, thank you. I really enjoyed my conversation today.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk featured a conversation between former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and historian Ted Widmer. They recently spoke in a virtual environment through an online presentation as part of the 2020 Champlain Institute. This year's theme is November 3rd, What's at Stake? Stay tuned for more Speaking in Maine programs featuring talks from this year's Champlain Institute. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchak. Thanks for joining us.